Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to another version of Value Investor's Edge Live. Today, we're hosting Michael Boyd. He's an independent researcher and analyst with his own research service hosted on Seeking Alpha, Energy Income Authority, where he focuses on basically all spectrums of the energy sector, but particularly a little bit more focus on the dividend payers, helping investors find investment opportunities with a more stable dividend background. The energy space, of course, has been notorious for both underperforming stocks, but also a lot of distribution cuts, a lot of landmines out there. Not all too dissimilar than some of the stuff that we've experienced in the shipping sector. I know Michael's expanded his coverage a little bit more recently, and we'll talk more about that in today's interview, but just a brief background of what he does. Michael, thanks for taking the time to join us today.
Anytime. You know, I'm always happy to have a chat with you.
Yeah, man, it's always fun. We did a Traders for a Cause energy seminar, about a month ago now. And it's interesting to see some of that stuff starting to pan out here with the election and such.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's something we'll talk about, but there's a lot of fear around energy heading into the election, which I think you saw in some of the stock prices earlier in the year, but it really hasn't like panned out that way. And I think that's really true across a lot of the sectors in general. So,
yeah, I was hoping we'd have, a little bit more concrete. I mean, it depends on who you talk to, but some more concrete election results before we did today's event. Hence why we scheduled it for Friday afternoon.
Yeah, right.
I think this is probably going to be one of the most widely listened to events we've done, just because of the increasing interest in energy, and especially now that the election is done. I think the live attendance today is a lot smaller because it's, Friday afternoon, it's Friday evening in Europe, but I think we'll see a lot of interest in this. Before we begin, just, the formalities, nothing you hear today constitutes investment advice in any form from myself or Michael. We'll give disclosures as much as we can on positions we own. You can just assume if there's no disclosure because we forgot or something, you can assume we're probably talking our book. So just be aware of that. Some of these names have been really volatile. One name in particular, ALTM, Altus Midstream. I own I wouldn't say super substantial position, but it's a couple percent of my portfolio. And that's a name that is super volatile. So even though we might talk about it, we're recording on 6 November at 1 in the afternoon. Look, I mean, if that thing doubled, I could sell it within hours. If it stays the same, I probably won't. Right. So just stocks like that, right? Keep in mind that those disclosures may change. Michael, anything you want to add to those up front?
I mean, yeah, I mean, like I said, like as I go through, if I mention something that I have like a disclosure, I'll be sure to mention it. Other than that, I mean, I'm happy to kind of get into it and we'll kind of go through it.
Yeah, we'll just keep it above board. I mean, two guys talking about, their research and their stocks and stuff. We got to get that out of the way and make sure that we're not, talking about too aggressively.
Yeah, for sure. We're keeping it above board. Yeah.
Absolutely. So thanks everyone for joining us, and we'll jump right into it. So Michael, I know we still don't have election results. I don't want to offend anyone, on the call or listening to the recording later, but it seems like scientifically, and if you go to the gambling markets and look at them, 97-98% Joe Biden presidential victory at this point, and a pretty clear lock, it seems like. I know there's still some toss-up stuff going on in Georgia, but it seems like a Republican Senate, a very tight balance, probably going to be 51, barely, right? I mean, it's at that point where the Democrats get 50, they win on the VP vote. But point being, a very narrow GOP Senate, a very close House with a slight Democratic edge, and it looks like a Joe Biden administration going forward in January. So with all that said, I know it's not 100% locked in yet, hence why the news hasn't called it and stuff. But what does that mean for energy and into 2021 and beyond?
Yeah, I mean, that's been kind of my working assumption for the past couple months is a Biden victory and, you know, a locked up Senate. So it's kind of a more of a gridlock scenario. And, you know, as we talk about energy and like the political and regulatory environment, you know, a lot of those topics matter. Whether you think about like, you know, some things that have been discussed, like a federal lease ban on drilling, you know, how green energy subsidies play out, you know, a fracking ban in whatever form that might take. And I think in general, even if we think about if, you know, the Congress did get flipped, you always have the U.S. Supreme Court as a backstop. So going through a lot of recent cases, like if you look up like Atlantic Coast and that whole pipeline decision, that was actually very bipartisan. That was a 7-2 decision. That was before Ruth Bader Ginsburg died, unfortunately. But, you know, it's still a very commonplace where a lot of Supreme Court decisions have been pretty actually pro-energy in some ways. Like another example would be they reversed a lower court ban on nationwide toll permits, which will play into Equitrans, which we'll probably touch on at some point in this call. But, you know, looking forward, I mean, energy in general, I think, is actually in a pretty good spot heading into 2021 and forward. There are only a few certain things that, you know, Biden, if we are in a situation where there's only some things he can touch. So a few topics that he might actually be able to address, like the Keystone XL permit, whether he wants to upset Canada in that way and actually kind of kill that pipeline and in the border crossing. That's something he can try to do. A federal lease moratorium on new permits, it's something he could do on his own without, you know, a substantial kind of congressional involvement. There's actually not really a lot of change that can take place. And even then, you know, obviously there's gonna be a lot of lawsuits, a lot of uncertainty in that way, but actual firm changes are probably years away.
Yeah, it's always interesting when you dive into the legalities of such and what can a president actually do versus what requires Congress and versus what will be challenged in the courts and whatnot. You know, one of the more extreme things I saw mentioned as something that's within technically within the presidential purview is export controls. So like some right. sort of export tariff or export ban on energy. That seems to me, it seems pretty extreme of a maneuver to do, but it seems like that's something that the presidential administration could at least get the ball rolling on. Has that been something that's come across your desk at all or you've thought about?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, if you go back a few years when we actually had, the oil export, ban lifted, that was actually a fairly bipartisan issue in a way too. And, there was some pretty broad support from Democrats on that. But then, it's always something that might change. Obviously the viewpoint on energy has shifted quite a bit on many of those topics since, I believe that was 15, 16 when that was lifted. So, things might change. And I really don't necessarily expect, to me, my view is there's going to be a lot more focus from Democrats on other issues other than energy early on in the administration. I think there's a lot of societal things that they want to touch first. So I think it's probably going to take a back burner. So I wouldn't really expect much change, especially 2021, 2022.
Yeah, I'm hoping not. I mean, I'm a shipping investor, as you know, so that would be devastating.
That would definitely roil your book a little bit too, depending on
exactly. Exactly. And of course, the VLCC market and Suezmax market for crude exports is already, down. So, an export ban would be devastating. But I don't think that's been a serious conversation in the United States for, 5+ years now, right? I mean, and you got to look at it in a sense of like a global geopolitical realm as well. I mean, what would that require? What would that mean? That would be, something involving, it would have to be some sort of global agreement where, OPEC is also somewhat contributing to some sort of like, I mean, now we're talking about like global carbon tax regime type. I mean, we're getting way outside of like presidential purview and stuff.
No, I definitely agree on that.
But I mean, I guess with that said, let's review, and I think most of the folks on the call today probably know this, but let's review kind of the valuations in the space just writ large on average. Like what kind of valuations, relatively speaking, are we seeing at the end of 2020 versus, the last 5 or 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, obviously valuations are down compared to where they were a couple years ago. I mean, it depends on the space you're looking at. But in general, especially if you look at something like midstream, earnings really have not changed there quite a bit over the past few years, really. You know, there's some topics, there's some discussion on, you know, oversupply in some basins and how the shifting U.S. production market will impact some pipelines. But especially if you think about, you know, the natural gas pipelines on the midstream side, there's really not really a case of oversupply there outside of a few very remote areas. So valuations there in the market, you're generally maybe paying on the low side 5 to 6 times EBITDA for gathering pipes, and you can kind of run that up to maybe like 9 times, 10 times for, you know, diversified large cap midstreams like Kinder Morgan, or, you know, some of the Canadian plays have actually traded a little bit firmer, like, you know, Enbridge or someone like that, around like 10 times. So that's the valuation range for midstream. I think, you know, upstream, you're generally paying closer to like 3 to 5 times EBITDA in this market, you know, assuming like, you know, current future strip, so like $40 oil. Most of those firms are trading at a discount to NAV. If you look at valuations on what acreage has sold for, really not a lot of activity in recent years, but even discounting that back, or if you do some sort of like cash flow based model, you're definitely getting that at a discount as well.
Yeah, it's very interesting to see when you do those NAV calculations, because I know they're a little bit different than when we talk about like NAV and shipping. Shipping is a little bit more of an active secondary market, but are you looking primarily at acreage comps, or do you look at like a PV10 sort of strip?
I do both. I think there's pros and cons to both. You know, it matters. I think PV10 especially matters when you're thinking about something which might have, you know, a big topic in upstream shale recently is kind of like overall quality of acreage. So how are well results in 2020 going to compare to well results in like 2030 or 2035? So generally the view is something like the Permian, or, you know, the Appalachian nat gas plays really have a lot of quality core acreage where, you know, well results really are not going to differ from one to the other. Whereas, you know, maybe in the Bakken, or, you know, some of the more niche plays like the Powder River Basin, you know, you might do extremely well on one well and then move, you know, 1,000 feet down the road and, you know, you see substantially different results. So I think PV10 kind of like plays into that, and how your assumptions kind of on costs and overall recovery throughout the years, but then also acreage, I think kind of firms, you know, the valuations there are like a firm backstop. So I think it's always pertinent to see what someone else is willing to pay, you know, in a third party market for comparable acreage.
Yeah, certainly makes sense in a volatile and downward trajectory market like we've had in most of 2020. It's good to see a last done and see that reaffirmed by some other deals on the market. But yeah, I mean, you mentioned, I mean, different sectors, different valuations, but I mean, you mentioned 5 to 9x, maybe 10 on the very high outlier. So call it like 5 to 9, 6 to 9, if you will, for the enterprise value EBITDA. And this is at a time when the cost of leverage is like a record low as well. Which is fascinating, right? Because when you talk about multiples to an EBITDA, that's kind of leverage neutral, if you will. And the debt's, of course, in the total, but the implication would be that, you know, the multiple would be probably a little lower if your debt costs were really high, right? And the multiple would obviously be a little bit higher. I mean, we were talking about it just, you know, I want you to correct me because you're more the expert in this space, but we were talking about multiples 3, 4, 5 turns higher on across the board just a few years ago, right? I mean, what was the comp for, say, like 2014, 2015?
Yeah, no, if you go back to 2015, you know, people were happy to, you know, take 4% yield on some of these companies that were around at that time. You know, they're paying, you know, 15, 16, you know, close in some cases on like growthier plays, like 20 times EBITDA at the time. And, you know, that was when, you know, the market was so very accepting of, you know, MLPs in general and like the tax savings from it. And that's like the script there, it's flipped so much, right? So we've seen so much of a move away from the partnership structure and incentive distribution rights and all of those things. It's, you know, it's interesting to see how investors' attitudes have changed to, you know, certain setups or governance structures compared to what they were willing to accept back in 2015 and actually even encourage, right? Because, you know, incentive distribution rights, when we talk about those, you know, those were set up to try and tie the parties together, right? So investors want an income, they want a growing income, so why not put an IDR in place? So as, you know, income grows, then, you know, the general partner you know, shares in the benefit. So very interesting to see how the space has changed and evolved over time, and how multiples have been, you know, absolutely just kind of like crushed in You know, I'm definitely more of a credit investor guy. You know, I come from a credit background, so it's very interesting to see, you know, on the bond market side as well, you know, a lot of these firms, you know, corporate debt is trading at, you know, 3 to 5% indicated yields in a lot of places, you know, for investment grade or maybe just a touch below investment grade debt. And then you see the, you know, the equities on those securities trading, you know, 15%, you know, well-covered yields, right? It's a very, very large gap in between what credit investors are willing to accept and what equity investors are willing to accept. And, you know, in general, creditors tend to have a much longer viewpoint. And if, you know, the big bearish argument for energy in general is a short shelf life, then you would think creditors would be especially bearish at this time, but they're not.
It's so weird to see that in the market. And you see companies like, and these are good companies, but they're not the best, right? Stuff like Energy Transfer, which, you know, I don't know what your letter grade would be on that. I see them as maybe like a B minus or something. But you see companies like Energy Transfer, you know, putting out unsecured, you know, 5-10 year paper at like 3%. And right. It's just like, my goodness. And this isn't even like the top shelf company, right? And then you see, you know, in the shipping market, because that's where I'm from, you see these really solid companies like Navigator Holdings, which is a big ethylene exporter. They have an ethylene export facility. They're a big LPG transporter. And they have to do unsecured paper at 8%, you know? And their balance sheet is much cleaner than Energy Transfer's. So it's exactly what you said. Like the credit markets are fully backing these companies and the equity markets hate them. Another thing you brought up with the K-1s is interesting. I don't want to veer off into this too much. We're not tax experts, at least I'm not. But there's so much hatred for the K-1. And it's not, I mean, it's like the scam done by like tax preparers, right? I mean, they're not that complex of a form unless you have like some weird sort of like you manage your investments through a LLC stack or something. I mean, I've owned companies with K-1s for, you know, 4 or 5 years, and I probably foolishly, but I mean, I do my own taxes and the K-1 takes 5 minutes. I think there's only been one K-1, maybe two K-1s in my life, and it is only 5 years, but wild. And one of them was actually a shipping company. It was TK LNG when they did like a conversion, and that K-1 was a little crazy because they did like a conversion. So you had to do all these little, you know, there was like 20 different, you know, forms you had to, you know, a little, you had to like copy the papers to 20 different places. But even then, I mean, it was like an hour or two.
No. I mean, I still do my own taxes. I don't, you know, I actually still do them on paper. I'm weird like that, but you know, I've never really had any real, you know, problems with K-1s in general. And, you know, even if I was paying a tax preparer and maybe they wanted like $200 per K-1 for their, you know, couple minutes of work, right? I mean, you're seeding, you know, potential, you know, income in the 10, 15, 20% range when, you know, your alternatives outside the sector, even if you went to something like, you know, AT&T or something like that, you know, it's a world of difference. If you do the math versus what you're giving up, you know, it just doesn't make sense to avoid it just because of a little extra paperwork or a little extra money come tax time.
Yeah, and I will just leave it there because I know everyone has a different opinion and a viewpoint. But right. There's just a hatred for them. Almost everyone I talk to, mostly I would say kind of like that upper middle sort of like retail investor. I'd say that the person that invests, you know, anywhere from maybe 100,000 to like maybe 1 or 2 million. That sort of demographic seems to just despise these things. You know, 2 million north, you got more of a professional tax team going on your stuff and it's fine. And of course, if you're a really, really small investor, it doesn't really move the needle one way or the other. So we'll move from that. But you mentioned sort of the different multiples across the space. So what are some of your favorite sectors? Which sectors are you saying like this is the time to invest versus what sort of subsectors are you still avoiding? And you say, look, yes, it's value, but it's a value trap.
Yeah, I mean, you know, midstream is obvious. You know, I've liked the sector for quite a while, you know, stretching back to like, you know, 2018. I mean, really, that's where like my background in energy comes from and, you know, where a lot of my Seeking Alpha coverage started in energy. I'm a cash flow modeling guy. So, you know, the firm fee-based contracts that really underlies a lot of this stuff is, you know, makes it really easy for me to plug in on my side and kind of, you know, work out some assumptions and really build some cool, sweet little models to play with. So, you know, that's definitely a sector I still love. I think it's, you know, had some interesting aspects on the credit side with, you know, refinancing and stuff like that over the past few years, but still have a lot of love there. Upstream, I'm actually starting to dabble there a bit more than I used to. If you think about how upstream kind of treated investors in 2016 to 2018, it was still very much all about growing the business, getting scale, a lot of, capital spending. There really wasn't really a lot of value that was left behind to be distributed to equity owners. So that's really not a really a space I really played in. But things obviously changed. There's been a lot of balance sheet effort over the past couple of years to get them cleaned up. A lot of these companies now, through efficiencies, they can be, extremely, profitable and actually generate free cash flow, even like $40 strip. Natural gas. I mean, I think you really have to be careful there in the space in general, because I think people tend to think of Henry Hub as, gospel nationwide, and really in-basin pricing has been kind of a little spotty, especially in recent months. But there's a lot of appeal there too. Same thing, where there's, a real big push to actually rewarding shareholders in a meaningful way. And I think actually compared to some of like the oil majors, where there's been a lot of topic on whether dividends are sustainable or not, I actually really like the direction they're going towards. I think the push has really been towards variable dividend payments. So, when times are great, you pay out a little bit more. When times are tough, you kind of like trim it back, and you can kind of retain some to help you get through that period. And I think that's a great viewpoint to have from these management teams in a, in a very cyclical business. So I think those are probably your two main sectors I'm really interested in right now. Downstream, you're talking about a lot of refined product inventory right now, and arguably a lot of permanent demand destruction. So if you look out in the market today, you're seeing Marathon Petroleum, PBF Energy, Shell, everybody's making the decision to actually, bring a lot of refining capacity offline in the United States. Which I think is a necessary step. I think maybe 5 to 10% of it has to go. So we're probably, 50, 60% of the way there. And then once that takes place, then you have to give it a little bit of time for inventories to work and, crack spreads to kind of get back. There's still some spotty issues in some products like jet fuel. So I think, the low utilization rates in that space are going to take a while to work through. So I think we're maybe several quarters or a year away from where we can really kind of really talk about some upside in the downstream space. And, on the flip side, I'm pretty bearish. Another space to really look at would be oil field services. So, all those good things I really talked about in upstream, a lot of that's come from just operators being extremely efficient with how they drill wells, a lot less completions out in the market today, much lower permits being issued than what was in the past. So there's just so much capacity in that market. You're seeing all the big fish in the industry like Halliburton kind of move away from like these capital intensive, completions focused businesses. So if you think about something like pressure pumping or proppant, or like, the frac sand companies, we've talked about Hi-Crush and companies like it before. I think we're years away from that industry actually cutting enough supply to really kind of generate those mid-cycle earnings. So I think there's still a lot of short opportunities in that space, which I think is, great to have, because, especially in energy, it's always hard to tell where oil or natural gas prices are going to go. So I always like having a little bit, in my short book, at all times, even I'm pretty favorable on a sector overall. So I think there's a lot of opportunities in oil field services to kind of, put on a little short exposure and kind of like balance yourself a little bit. And I think you can actually make money on both sides of those trades. So
it'll be interesting to watch. I've always valued some of the work you've done. If it wasn't bearish, it was at least cautionary. And I think you've had a lot of good reports in the past. I know you've been cautionary on Energy Transfer for years, just saying that, look, they got some troubles, they got some challenges. Maybe it's not a short, but it's just something to not get excited about. I think there was a point with Energy Transfer where every other day on Seeking Alpha, there was a new article out proclaiming that it was like the buy of the century or something. When there's so much groupthink on one stock, it's risky. So just so I can sum that up correctly, and tell me if I'm wrong, I heard that you like the midstreams the most. It's one of your favorite spots. You also think there's opportunity in natural gas upstream type businesses, a little bit riskier, but some opportunity there. You do not like sort of the refinery business, the downstream stuff. There's still some another year at least of headwinds. And then oil services. Is that a good summary?
Yeah, I think that's a good summary. I mean, downstream definitely has some different, angles to the business where you think about like petrochem versus like actual refined products. But yeah, I agree with you. I mean, if you think about, just the refined product space in general, I think it's probably a little too early there. So.
Okay, that's very interesting, because I know there's a few sort of MLP companies that have a lot of exposure to refineries, which normally, that refinery exposure is like and chemical exposure and pipeline, that's like top tier assets. But right now,
Definitely. You know, most of those partnerships, they tended to, be very willing to run pretty low coverage ratios, on the distribution. You know, volumes are generally viewed to be intact. You know, I've covered like PBF Logistics, for instance, is one that I've covered recently. So, PBF Energy recently shut down an East Coast refinery. So there's, minimum volume commitments that are on certain assets, that they support. But what happens when, the refinery is closed? What happens to all those storage assets, the pipeline assets, that kind of thing? Is it stranded, or is there an opportunity to pivot the business and just do some third-party storage deals, that kind of thing? So that's what really makes that kind of angle of that space a little bit different than if you're looking at something like, a gathering pipeline or something like energy transfer, right?
Certainly. Let's throw some meat on the bones here. So for folks listening, what are maybe like two or three of your top ideas or most interested stocks in those spaces that you liked? And maybe like a couple, maybe just one or two of stocks that are either outright shorts as a hedge or just something that you think is overrated or sort of a value trap that you'd avoid?
I mean, like DCP Midstream, I always like to start with that one. It's been a favorite for a very long time. Went down into the twos in March and April, which is where, I kind of like doubled down on that position. And, so I have kind of like, positions across all sorts of different cost bases in that name. But, they've beat earnings consistently coming off the lows. Management team is great in pivoting to what the market wants. So they're actually doing away with distributable cash flow in their reports. Everything's free cash flow now, which institutionals love. I think there's been a fundamental misunderstanding of how they do, they run their business, because they have a really great marketing arm and they actually tend to lease out pipeline space, on other parties to flow products. So they made a lot of money on that business. And I think a lot of investors kind of missed how attractive frac spreads were. If you think about natural gas liquids, right? You reject the NGLs or you actually kind of process it and, downstream it for sale. So I think versus Wall Street expectations, DCP has pretty continuously kind of been the biggest gap between my estimates and sell side in general. So that's really where I've had a lot of my investing dollars personally. On the flip side, if you think about on the oil space, Plains All American is a name I've covered on BIE before. So that's very oil focused, but once again, kind of really a misunderstood marketing business, which has really generated a lot of volatility in their EBITDA results in past quarters and really probably since 2018. But that business is kind of, it's working off a really low base at this point. Looking at guidance next year, there's only 50 million EBITDA attributed to the marketing business. I actually think they can make more than that. That's against, 2,200, 2,200 million in EBITDA from their actual kind of core kind of fee based business. So if you think about like they own assets in like Cushing on the Gulf Coast, kind of like around Mont Belvieu. They have assets on the East Coast. So they're very like a hub centric model. So they really own a lot of really great assets that are basically kind of irreplaceable in this market. And if you think about even in a kind of a low production, low volume market, that's where flows are still going to be in place. If you comp it against energy transfer, they're actually cheaper on EBITDA going forward. Even after the recent kind of like price dislocation, they put in place a $500 million buyback program, which is the largest authorization as a percentage of market cap in midstream right now. So they've got a great avenue to retire some units, and they've got a really conservative management team. So I think that's a great pick. Just on the short side, since I was kind of talking about oil field services a little bit earlier, I'm short RPC. Once again, disclosure wise, everything I've mentioned here, I'm either long or short. RPC is a smaller player in pressure pumping. So basically they operate the horsepower and all the supporting equipment necessary to frack a well. So if you think about fracking, pressure pumping has to be there. They actually have a great balance sheet. But they trade at a premium to the rest of the space on EBITDA and on per frac fleet, but they don't really earn better margins than anybody else. They're actually a smaller player, which really doesn't make sense. And if you look at what everyone else is doing around them, if you go back a few years, ProPetro bought pressure pumping assets from Pioneer Natural Resources. A lot of the upstream players used to own a lot of the pressure pumping stuff themselves. CNJ merged with King Group, and then recently Schlumberger merged its fleet with Liberty Oilfield Services. So there's a lot of consolidation going around them. But if you look at their some of their conference calls, they're very unwilling to kind of put their money to work that they have, or put that balance sheet to work and kind of pick up assets on the cheaps. So I really think they're being too conservative, kind of the whole ostrich in the sand kind of thing, and they're just trying to wait it out. And I think it's going to eventually kind of lead to some downward pressure on their share price. So those are three picks that I think really have a lot of asymmetry to them, like going forward into 2021.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So long DCP, long Plains PAA, and then short RPC. RPC is kind of a small, you know, smaller company, smaller market cap.
Size appropriately, it's definitely volatile. I mean, energy in general is volatile, but you know, I think, you know, as a percentage of my book, that's probably like 2%. You know, generally my shorts, I tend to take a basket approach, try and, you know, size things in the 1-2% range. That's not, you know, advice or anything, but that's just the way I kind of approach the space.
Yeah, is there a way to hedge that? Is there like a liquid options market so you could throw on like a protective call at like four?
Yeah, I mean, I think you can. I'm pretty sure there are options there. If not, you know, you actually just go long one of its peers, right? So Liberty Oilfield, they're actually the largest player in that space now. You know, obviously they got Schlumberger backing at this point, and they actually trade cheaper. So if you wanted to pair trade it, I think that's a great way to do it too, as well. If you wanted to kind of go that route, or you could kind of, you know, go someplace else in oilfield services, you know, something like, you know, Rod Lift or something like that would probably be a good balancing point.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. You know, it's very interesting when you look at DCP, and, you know, that is where it kind of outlines the value of having an understanding of the sector like you do, and like you provide in your service, because you look at, yeah, their 52-week low was like $2. Of course, that was one day, it was intraday. It was like $4 the next day, but, you know, doubled overnight, basically. But just an example of how, you know, information asymmetry was back in March. You know, everybody was panicking, everybody was dumping the stocks, and that's a six bagger, right?
Yeah.
And it's still not even, it's still very cheap when you look at like a 5-year average.
No, exactly. I mean, I think where a lot of my alpha has really come from, you know, looking back the past few years, it's really on kind of like those, you know, real strong troughs in this market, and really kind of picking up stuff for cheap and kind of taking a little bit, you know, off at the peaks. You know, even recently DCP, and, you know, a lot of my members tend to trade it as well. I mean, it's been, if you look at the chart, it's been great to buy at 10 and sell at 15. So there's great ways to kind of like leverage, you know, how these companies are likely to react into earnings and how the outlook is, and kind of, you know, trade around them. You know, much like shipping, you know, there's obviously some buy and hold opportunities, and I think you can make great money in energy, you know, just holding, you know, quality companies, you know, throughout, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 years. But there's also great trading opportunities as well, if you kind of like have a, you know, you can kind of take the technical aspect and then kind of have like a fundamental, you know, backing for what you're doing as well.
Yeah, you know, energy is hated, and it has had overall a very brutal 2020. But just with hindsight, of course, you know, we didn't know this back in March, but just a buying opportunity of a decade there. And of course, we say that, right? And some of these names have doubled or tripled, or DCP's up six times. But you look at big names, you know, the big kind of bellwethers of the industry, you think of like the Energy Transfers or the Schlumbergers or the Exxons, and, you know, they're still basically in the same neighborhood. Let's talk real quick, Schlumberger, because you said you don't like oil field services. That's kind of the bellwether, right, of that space. How do you feel about it? Is that still kind of a value trap, or is there some interest in a big company like that?
I think there's some interest in I really like how they've kind of pivoted, you know, they're definitely kind of going towards a more capital light business model, more on the services side, some more software, which I think is really going to have a lot of appeal to the prototypical kind of, you know, institutional investor or the market in general, right? And, you know, everybody loves, you know, software as a services or really capital light businesses. I think the question is how much kind of pain and pressure they have to undergo in order to get there, you know, with asset disposals and, you know, and kind of like, you know, stacking, you know, equipment that really doesn't have much use in this day and age. I think we're maybe like a hair too early in general on some of the larger names, but I think, you know, contrary to some of you might think small cap might lead in a, you know, an upward move or something like that, but I would actually kind of would bias towards the larger names, you know, as we look out into like late 2021, early 2022.
Yeah, it's interesting to see too. And of course, you reduce your risk because, you know, Schlumberger is not going to get blown out. Whereas some of those other oil field services, yeah, you might be batting for like a 4x or 5x or something if you're super bullish. But you could also be looking at a zero, right? And a
Right.
Schlumberger is not, it's not going to go to zero. I mean, but it might go down, but
Yeah.
it's not that sort of magnitude. Whereas at the same time, if you look at a Schlumberger chart and you look at their core earnings potential in a more bullish outcome, you're also still looking multi-bagger. So it's a very interesting sort of setup. It's
Yeah, I mean,
rare
I
to see a
think.
company like that, right? With any sort of, usually when you talk about a company like Schlumberger, you're talking about an upside of like 20%, right? Not much
Right.
higher.
Yeah, you definitely have to think about these companies in like a mid-cycle viewpoint. It's really like any cyclical, right? It's, you can't really look at like how it's trading today or how it was trading at the peak of the market. It's really what earnings are going to be, on average over the long term for the business and how that compares against the pricing today. And if and I guess the bigger question is too, like you said, some will go up, some will go to zero, is whether they can survive to that point, right? Because credit markets in general for energy are it's not really a great situation, and capital can be scarce. So definitely larger names have a much better potential to kind of get to that mid-cycle earnings as you see kind of, older equipment for whatever reason either get scrapped or it just becomes outdated or it gets taken offline. And that's when a lot of that value can accrue and you can kind of get the margins back up to kind of like a mid-cycle level.
Yeah, it's not that much different than shipping in that sort of way where it's you got to be really careful looking at, you know, just historical price patterns and such. You really got to understand where the underlying value is at, where the near term and medium term earnings potential is at. And there's a lot of, I guess, value trap potential in this space. And there's a lot of stocks that are kind of under the radar as well. So one more big name, just because it's controversial and a lot of people are talking about it, ExxonMobil, right? What's your viewpoint on them at this point?
I mean, I've always been a little bit skeptical of their dividend policy. I kind of get the management viewpoint. They've always said, we're investors at the bottom of the cycle, and whether it be drilling prices or services or whatever, it makes sense to buy at the bottom. But I think in general, just optics wise, it's always painful to see a company kind of like cut headcount or reduce benefits or abandon otherwise viable production fields just because the equity shareholders are draining off a lot of the cash flow underlying it. I don't think there's any reason for them to cut. It's one of those situations where I might disagree with their policy, but I don't think that's necessarily enough to prompt a cut. Probably if you look out to 2022, 2023, you get to a point where they're at least break even on where they're capital spending is likely to be, and all their cash obligations, they should at least be able to tread water at that point. By comparison, I really like the push from shale plays into variable dividends. I think that makes more sense in this business. I don't think you'll really see Exxon ever kind of move towards that, but and I think their integrated model, really kind of protects them from as much volatility as something like Diamondback or whatever. But I think in general, I think the dividend at Exxon, the payments just quite frankly got stretched a little too far over the years. It's just a tendency, to slowly kind of creep up a dividend, and eventually it gets to be too much of a drag and it kind of got past where it should be. And it's tough to see them kind of lose some of the credit rating status that they spent decades building towards. But still very high quality paper, still very much in demand, and $10-20 billion or whatever they might need to get to 2022 or 2023 where they can at least kind of break even. And I think that's something they can raise and kind of get through just fine. I'm not personally long. I think a lot of the international plays, whether it be the European majors, make a lot of sense, especially if you're kind of pessimistic on United States oil production. Even for someone like ExxonMobil, if you told management that we're going to severely restrict your assets in the Permian and elsewhere, but market-wide pricing, it's going to push up everything. So now Brent's $80 a barrel, whatever. I think they'd probably be happy to take the $80 and the higher margins that comes with it, on their international assets. So I think it's a great way to diversify if you're a little like I said, a little pessimistic on the United States, but I personally don't have any positions there at the moment.
So in much less words, like meh.
Yeah, no, I mean it's something where I think I'm definitely kind of counterculture, or I think you see a lot of folks kind of very pessimistic on the dividend. I'm always happy to call a dividend cut. You know that, but I don't really think it's going to happen here.
Yeah, so not much fireworks in either direction. Just kind of boring.
Right.
Okay, let's make things more exciting because Exxon was boring. I feel bad for even bringing it up. look, ALTM, Altus Midstream. My gosh, who would know that? You know, two of my biggest wins this year, and of course, it's been a tough year for me personally, just being honest. But two of my biggest wins would be like these fringy small companies. You know. Navios Containers on the shipping side is my largest position. It's been enormous. And then the second one, it was a much smaller position for me. It was unfortunately way too small in hindsight. It's always in hindsight. But ALTM, man, it tripled yesterday off like not much of a change in their business, right?
Nothing. That's the funny thing. Nothing really like changed. It was just mainly capital allocation, right? So, I mean, it's a perfect setup for that kind of thing because, you know, for those not familiar with Altus, it was a kind of like an IPO, came from Apache to kind of support some of their drilling in the Alpine High play, which is like a natural gas angle in the Permian. That didn't play out as a lot of the management hoped it would. Drilling results were a little bit mixed. Costs were really high in basin pricing for natural gas in the Permian. Remember, everybody's just lighting gas on fire in the Permian rather than actually shipping it. Because quite frankly, you weren't getting any money for it. You know, Waha hub pricing was zero for a very long time. Apache still owns 79%, I believe. It was brought public with Kayne Anderson. They own 10%. A bunch of other hedge funds own this thing. So really, there was very little available float. It was 10% short. For those who are not familiar, they implemented a dividend policy. They said they're going to pay. Well, they recommended to the board to implement a dividend policy, to clarify. So there's not 100% fact that this is going to be the path yet. They wanted to pay out $6 a year in dividends. The stock was at 10 bucks. So it was 60%, indicated yield starting in 2021. So no short, I'm sure, really wanted to own that. You know, everyone that wasn't really familiar with the firm suddenly had a lot of interest in something that was paying 60%. And then you had a stock that was trading, 30,000 shares a day. And then I think volume yesterday was like 4 or 5 million, I believe. It could be higher than that. It was a great momentum trade. I had actually owned Altus earlier in the year. I had taken the position off a little bit for tax lock sale, but actually bought at the open yesterday. Even with it up, 70% or so, it was pretty clear to me there was a lot of meat left on that bone. So it was a pretty easy, five-figure win for me just on a day trade. For you, I think you had a basis, down in the 10 range as well. So you actually were in there a little bit earlier than me. But it's a great opportunity. That's one of those cases where, really having a lot of expertise and kind of like a niche company and kind of recognizing when there's going to be a potential for a big win like that. You don't really see those every day. I'm not going to say that, I know exactly when, there's going to be another Altus right around the corner, but it only takes a few of those every year to really kind of like, create some big wins for your portfolio. So.
Yeah, that was just such an exciting stock. And that the funny thing, like you mentioned, I mean, all the fundamentals, all the value case, everything, nothing changed, right? I mean, it was more or less the same. It was just a matter of like making that policy of a dividend. It's just a recommendation of a dividend, right? Kind of funny.
Right. Yeah. I mean,
that one thing, woke some folks up. They're like, oh, this is actually, if you take 60% yield and it's covered by 1.8, that thing was trading at like 1x forward cash. I mean, it was just insane. And it's like you mentioned, quality pipes backed by, very strong firms. But it was just sitting out there, right? And no one really covered it. I think Clement Mullins is actually on the line today. He is our associate analyst at Value Investor's Edge. He actually wrote a public article about ALTM just like 2 months ago. And, when he put out the public article, it was well written, but I was kind of thinking, well, you're kind of a year early, dude. So kudos
to
Clement
for
just... This guy just like nailed the bottom of it.
Yeah, great timing. Because if you go back the dividend policy was always going to be a thing, right? So like you said, earnings expectations really haven't changed. So if you go back to like Q4, they were like, all right, we're going to implement a dividend 2021, maybe 2020. And then you go forward a quarter and then it was like, all right, it's going to be 2021. And then if you go to Q2 when the market was like in a big mess, they were like, suddenly the dividend mentioned was like erased from like their IR slide deck, right? So everybody was like, all right, you know, they've got, you know, a decent amount of debt. They have these like somewhat toxic preferred, you know, sitting out there. Maybe they're going to retain that cash, you know, hold it, pay that down. And, you know, maybe this dividend thing is going to be like a 2023, 2024 story, right? So it's a big change to actually kind of flip the switch and go back to, you know, a pretty aggressive, you know, I think 1.8 times coverage is actually, you know, probably the normal nowadays, but, you know, going from nothing to $6 a share is a very massive change. And I think it's kind of interesting to see how that stock reacted and then contrast that against, you know, the rest of midstream, which has really been very much, you know, we're going to lower the distribution, kind of increase coverage, focus on delivering. So, you know, this management team took a very, very aggressive stance in a sector that's really been quite cautious, even with all the bullish fundamentals that we've talked about, right? So it's interesting to see how investors reacted to that. And it's curious to see if that, you know, might actually lead to a little bit of change, or if we do see some dividend hikes from midstream in general and a little bit more aggression, since, you know, at least if you look at what the outlook was in Q2 of this year, it's certainly not as bearish as many feared. So looking forward, I think there's a lot less risk, and you might see management teams willing to actually kind of like increase payouts to shareholders going forward when investors might not necessarily expect it.
Yeah, it's very interesting, and I think it's obviously way too early to say that was the right move. Of course, you know, they're still, even now they're trading at what is it, a 20% yield right now at $30. So I mean, it and that's an insane yield. So I mean, it's too early to say there's a right move, but I say, you know, write down ALTM on a piece of paper today. And write down $30, but also in parentheses, you know, write down 10 or 12, because that's kind of where it was before the policy was announced. And then take a company that is just taking the opposite, you know, spectrum, say like a company like ET, like Energy Transfer, and write down $6, right? And put that on your piece of paper. And then if you want to throw a shipping comp in there, one that we love to hate, Capital Product Partners, CPLP, just going the complete opposite, just mind-boggling stupid direction in my opinion, take that company and write down 750 on your piece of paper, and let's come back in a year, right? And let's see, you know, if that helped, right? Because right now it's too early. We're just talking about day trades, and you know, phenomenal trade, by the way, Michael. I actually wanted to grab some of that yesterday morning as well. I, you know, posted that in the chat, but I didn't have any, I had no cash really in my tax-free accounts. And, you know, a day trade, it's risky, and you don't want to do it on margin. With a stock like ALTM, I'm not going to put that on margin. So I missed out, but congrats on you, dude. That was an awesome day trade. I think everyone, besides listening to us chat, we could do this all day, but I think people want to know, and I know it's not an easy question, it's kind of silly in some ways, but like, what's the next, you know, ALTM? Is there a couple, maybe just like two or three sleepers that, you know, no promises that they're going to be multi-baggers, but have multi-bagger potential that are kind of like sleepers that everyone's kind of just like kicked around and forgotten about?
I mean, there's definitely some opportunities out there. I haven't really covered it yet. I'm going to cover CLMT in the coming, you know, weeks, probably. They've been trying to pitch a sale of a refinery. Now they're kind of like pitching maybe selling a lubricants business. There's a lot of kind of like up and down on what exactly they're going to, you know, what direction, strategic direction they're going to take. The lubricants unit does have a lot of value. I think it's undervalued in general. They put a lot of money into some of the refining businesses that they have. You know, those businesses are profitable. You know, I think there's some upside optionality there. I don't even necessarily think you need to go like too speculative or fringy on some of these things to really see a lot of upside. You know, going back to DCP, you know, that's trading at like, you know, still 7.2 times, you know, EBITDA for next year. You know, this is a company you should trade at, you know, 10 to 11. So if you really see a lot of multiple expansion in some of these companies, I think it'll take off. Actually, on the upstream side, I own XEC. They're really beaten down. They own a lot of federal land exposure on the New Mexico side of the Permian. So they're kind of split 50-50 between New Mexico and Texas, right? So if you think about, you know, a potential Biden restriction on leases on the New Mexico side, that might impact, people tend to think that might impact them a lot. It really won't. They have quite a lot of inventory of in-hand permits to drill there if they want to. They have substantial inventory on the Texas side to drill there until some of this all gets shaken out. And right now they're trading at a, several turn discount to EBITDA versus peers. And you know, we haven't really talked about it today, but there's been a lot of upstream consolidation, a lot of pickups from many different companies kind of rolling up a lot of these smaller drillers with really quality acreage. I think XCC makes a lot of sense there for someone to buy. At least for the moment, those purchases have really been kind of like stock based with not a lot of premium, but that might change as opportunities kind of dry up. So I think there's an upstream play with a lot of great potential as well.
Yeah, very interesting. So, you know, on the risk spectrum, I imagine CLMT is kind of the riskiest. XEC is kind of maybe in the middle, and DCP is probably one of the least risky. Is that fair to say?
That's a fair assumption to make. Yeah.
Okay. But even with maybe the companies that are, you know, a lot less risky, like DCP, you know, theoretically, there's still maybe 2 to 3 times upside if you assume some sort of like reversion to, you know, call it 10x EBITDA. Is that
right? There's definitely a lot of, you know, a lot of times some of us, you know, when we talk about, you know, something revaluing 1, 2, 3 turns on EBITDA, I think it's easy to forget how much leverage especially is on some of these. And this is true in shipping as well, I'm sure, but, you know, in midstream, you know, so, you know, those small moves can have really drastic impacts on the underlying equity price. You know, DCP, you know, if we go back to, you know, even before like 2020, right? You know, this was a stock that was, you know, was trading in, you know, in the 25, 26 range. So that's a double from here if we just get back to where it was, you know, in December, right? And, you know, it seems so long ago in some ways, but, you know, in the grand scheme of things, it's, you know, it's less than 12 months where we were trading, you know, double from where we are now. And fundamentally, the company is posting, you know, record quarterly earnings, you know, quarter after quarter. So I think that's the really special thing in a lot of these energy companies is, you know, the quality of the earnings and how well they've stood up to arguably the most, you know, disastrous period in their history in many cases.
Yeah, for sure. You know, one of the questions we had in the chat, which I think is very relevant. I apologize to Europeans when I said K1s weren't a big deal. I realized they were a very big deal.
Yeah, I was going to caveat international is definitely
One of the questions was, you know, what are some of the plays that are not partnerships? I think you've already mentioned a lot of them. I think, you know, CLMT, is that a partner? I think that's not a partnership, right? What about XEC? What about FANG? Are those?
Yeah, I mean, there's a, you know, Altus actually, you know, 1099 issuing, you know, so that's a great way to kind of like play something with a little bit more leverage. But, you know, there's a lot of 1099 options nowadays. You know, I think a lot of folks like Antero Midstream, depending on how they feel about, you know, Antero Resources, that's a 1099, or you can go really safe into something like, you know, Williams or Enbridge. You know, Plains, we talked about Plains earlier, you know, they have a 1099 ticker through PAGP. So you can kind of take that route and kind of avoid the K1 and you're not really like missing out on much. They trade pretty much in parity. So it's definitely in the midstream space, there's plenty of 1099 payers that you can kind of like go with, and I don't necessarily think it hurts you. I think Targa Resources would be another that definitely gets mentioned on VIE quite a lot. So definitely more than a few ways to play it, you know, if you really want to avoid the K1s, you know, for whatever reason, including, you know, international investors, which definitely have more than a few reasons to avoid them.
Yeah, certainly makes sense. I think PAGP is especially interesting because of the conviction, right, you have on the overall business there. And it's you're just buying basically the K1 firm minus the K1. That's all that is.
Yeah, yeah. For an American investor, it's whether they want, you know, whether they want the tax benefit or, you know, what structure they want. But, you know, for investors like, you know, internationally, it's a great way to get into it without that, you know, or someone on the institutional side that just really wants to avoid K1s, you know, for like a whatever reason, whether that be like structural in a fund or whatnot.
Absolutely. Well, we're coming to the close here, but I think one of the questions that was posted in the chat, it's just a great way to kind of, you know, sort of like in this conversation, the way we began, sort of a big picture view on the sector. You know, the question is basically asking about this huge divestment wave that we're kind of in the middle of, right, against the oil and gas sector. I think Jim Cramer said about a year ago that big oil is big tobacco, right? He made that analogy. And we're seeing that happen, that all these large funds, whether they're sovereign funds or hedge funds, they're pulling out of oil and gas left and right. As mentioned by the person who made the question, look, we're nowhere near the end of this wave. I mean, I don't know where we're at, if we're third right. inning or fifth inning, but we're somewhere in the middle of it. If we believe that oil is going to be higher, which I think that's a whole nother discussion, but if we believe that oil is going to be higher once COVID's done, which again, different belief, but if we believe that, is it better to just go long oil and go long futures or some sort of like instrument there? Versus like the pain and frustration and agony of like buying these E&P companies. How do you look at that? Do you consider maybe just buying the commodity, or do you view the companies themselves as more interesting?
I mean, the way I tend to, approach upstream is, I don't believe I have a materially advantage in being able to predict whether oil is going to go up, down, sideways, or wherever it might be. So I tend to kind of price these, based on models if they're trading at a discount to future strip, right? So, if I'm in something like XCC and I'm looking at the quality of their acreage and the cash flow it's going to throw out, at an appropriate discount rate, whatever I might assign, which, these days energy tends to be like between 10 to 12%. Is the future flows that they're gonna present, better than what I might get in oil? And for me to take a stake, the answer is always yes. For me personally, I don't really tend to play in the upstream side or on the actual commodities or future side. But thinking forward about the divestment wave, it's a very relevant topic. I think at the end of the day, there will, obviously the pool will be smaller, but there's going to be a certain subset. Whether it be, hedge funds or retail investors or whomever that's going to be willing, to kind of take a step there and, take on that kind of like a anti kind of consensus view. But broadly too, I think we can have a discussion, and we talked about this, in the panel for Traders for a Cause, right? Using the ESG in this industry, right? So you're seeing a lot of these companies, Enbridge has a pretty strong renewables side of their business. You're starting to see Williams or various upstream companies start to use, solar out in the field to kind of reduce the energy costs. A lot of these companies have started out putting out some great presentations talking about reducing methane emissions or how their businesses, flare less gas versus peers. And I think those are steps that, the industry can take and that can eventually, work its way into luring back some of the capital that's been lost, or at least do a better job relative to, the rest of the industry and how outflows are going to be. I think there's opportunities there regardless. And I think there's, different ways to approach it, whether you think, if it's going to be like tobacco and, or sin stocks in general, where some investors just won't touch it, but a lot of these stocks still perform, great from, if you look at tobacco from like the 90s to, to today or whatever. Or if you take it from the viewpoint that these companies are going to take some steps to actually mitigate some of the, the ESG kind of risk to their business. I think oil and gas in general has been very slow to respond to that. But I actually think they've kind of learned their lesson a little bit, and they're actually putting forth some pretty solid effort, I think, in actually responding to investor, cares and needs, beyond just, numbers-based return on invested capital or something like that. They're actually, broaching some of these topics.
Yeah, it's very interesting. And that really is like the question to ask, right? I mean, we kind of just put it in there at the end, but the next question, and you kind of hit the next question, but the next question is like, is there even an investable future in this space? And I think the big tobacco parallel is so interesting because, regulation, there was this multi-billion dollar lawsuit, right? With like a 15, 20 year tailed payout. And people were saying that was the death of tobacco. This was in the mid 90s. And it turned out to be like one of the best things that ever happened to that industry, because it just bankrupted and it drove out every little fringe player in the tobacco space. The regulators and tobacco were almost like partners, right, in a sick way of like raising taxes. And like, so it actually turned, I think, I don't have the number right in front of me, but I think from like 1995 to 2010, that 15 year period, maybe even 2015, call it 20 years, I think tobacco even outperformed Apple. I mean, it was just insane. So, some of these things in energy, if you think about regulators coming in heavy handed, there's not going to be any new pipelines, or at least the fringier ones, right? There's not going to be a lot of new supply. A lot of those things in a weird way are actually bullish, right? For the pipes that already exist and for the fields that are already being exploited. And so we don't know how it's going to play out. But I think the tobacco analogy is so often used to like, ridicule people who want to invest in energy. And if you actually study the numbers, tobacco was like a fantastic investment in 1995.
Right. And that's why we focus so much on yield, right? Because, you know, in the grand scheme of things, if you're buying something, you know, 20, 30% yield, right? You're getting your cost back in, you know, 3 to 5 years, give or take, right? Assuming no changes to the payout, right? So, I mean, obviously there's opportunity cost for that. You know, what if I invested in tech? What if I invested in, you know, Apple or something instead? But, you know, that's a decent, you know, backstop, right? You know, compared to, you know, 2016, if we were having the discussions where, you know, upstream energy was, unless you were like Exxon, you were paying like nothing, right? So there was no even like a promise of, you know, cash flow to, you know, to an equity investor. It was just, you know, hopefully selling the share to someone down the road at a higher price. At least in these cases, especially midstream, starting to be so in upstream and other areas of the market, you know, you're getting those cash flows, you know, money's flowing into your you know, investment account, you know, on a quarterly basis. And, you know, whether you want to reinvest that in midstream, or maybe that's just your cash flow that you dedicate to tech or some other sector, that, you know, you just need to treat these as like a, you know, almost like, you know, like a Buffett analogy, you know, like the cigar butt kind of viewpoint here. And, you know, whether the residual value as you, if you think oil and gas is, you know, on its way out the door, you know, if is it going to happen in 2035, 2050, is this, you know, everyone is just way too bullish on green energy and it's going to be further down the road. You just have to have your own assumptions on how long that'll take and how these businesses are going to be impacted and what capital might be returned to you over that period of time, and weigh that against what you could have gotten in, you know, in the market, you know, which, you know, obviously is trading at, you know, pretty crazy valuations at the moment. You know, so that's absolutely the big thing with energy, is the relative valuation of the sector today. You know, it's cheaper than 2016, whereas the rest of the market, you know, if you look at something like, you know, tech or Apple or whatever, you know, Apple was a great buy in 2016, but is it a great buy in 2020? That's the question.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the market is basically saying that energy is dead in like 2030. And if you believe it's 2040 or 2050, it's going to be a great investment. If it's 2030 or sooner, then yeah, the market's probably closer to correct on this one. Michael, we reached the end of our time, but I want to give you the opportunity, since we're hosting this on Value Investor's Edge, I want to give you the opportunity as well to just talk about your service for a minute and how folks can get a hold of you there and what sort of stuff that you provide specifically on that service.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, Energy and Income Authority, you know, started as a midstream focused service. We've kind of, you know, expanded coverage out to upstream. You know, I also, any picks outside of the energy space that I find appealing, I throw those in there too. So, you know, whether that be stocks, bonds, preferreds, you know, wherever my, you know, investing mind takes me, you know, I definitely share that with everyone. Big focus for me within this service is making sure that, you know, number one thing is not getting into a situation where you're investing in poor companies, bad companies, you know, any situation where you're going to eat a massive loss. You know, my focus has always been risk management. And, you know, to a point too, on the subscription side of the business, I plow a lot of the money back into the business. So there's a lot of data that I provide on permits, completions that I think, you know, a lot of investors have a lot of interest in. So if you want to see how many wells, you know, ExxonMobil drilled in the Permian in 2018, I've got that data for you. If you want to see what permits they've applied for this year, I've got that too. I provide a lot of really great tracking tools and services that, you know, a lot of investors really enjoy using. You know, I have a midstream energy tracker that has, you know, I think 40 or 50 firms on it at this point to compare, really try to kind of you know, taking a page out of Jay's book and, you know, and his tracking and tools, you know, a lot of the, you know, some investors tend to be very, you know, chart and graphic focused or really like playing with spreadsheets. So I try to make them happy, you know, as well, beyond just, you know, the prototypical kind of like, you know, stock write up or whatever. So I think, you know, I like to think I provide a lot of value, and, you know, I think, you know, members seem to really, you know, really enjoy the service. It's, you know, since I pivoted to energy, you know, this point last year, you know, I have, you know, four times the members that I did then. So definitely trying to continue to grow, and I'm gonna be happy to have more folks on board with me.
Absolutely. Thank you, Michael. I appreciate you joining us. And apologies for running a little bit long, but I think there's good value in this conversation. Just again, for disclosures, Michael already mentioned pretty much all the stocks that he's long and short, respectively. I have a long position in several of these names. I think the names that we discuss most pertinently was ALTM, Altus Midstream, a long position there, Energy Transfer, Plains All American, and Exxon would be, I think, the big ones that I have a long position in. Michael, anything to add on disclosure basis?
That looks like, I mean, I'm long DCP as well. Other firms that we might have mentioned, I think that was it. And I'm short RPC. So I think that covers the basis on our book.
All right, fantastic. Thank you, everyone, for listening in.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Jay Mintzmyer runs the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Value Investor's Edge there.